Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who were the Cro-Magnons, and how were these first anatomically modern humans able to endure after the last of the Neanderthals faded from the Earth? The two species appear to have coexisted for thousands of years, but questions remain about what sort of interaction they may have had. The study of skeletal fragments shows that their bodies were quite different from one another, and artifacts suggest that their brains and cultures worked in different ways as well. Brian Fagan is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. His new book is called Cro-Magnon: How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Brian, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You open the book with this imagined encounter between a Cro-Magnon family and a Neanderthal. How would they likely have viewed one another?
It's really a fascinating question, because it's something we just simply will never know. But you're dealing with people who were very familiar with one another, in the sense that if you saw a Neanderthal, you knew that they were them, an exotic, obviously different sort of human, with whom they had as little connection as possible. I describe the Neanderthals as the quiet people. I think they spent a lot of time observing the Cro-Magnons and kept out of their way. And I think the whole strategy, most likely, on both sides, was to avoid one another unless there was some mutual advantage in, say, exchanging honey for skins or something like that. So in a way, it was a sort of, we live alongside each other and we avoid each other. I think the Cro-Magnons probably thought that the Neanderthals were inferior because they didn't have fluent speech. And of course, they may have smelt quite differently, and Cro-Magnons may have been repelled by Neanderthals physically.
You are careful here to knock down the stereotype that the Neanderthals were just savages. What do we know about their culture and about their mental capacities?
The Neanderthals have been much insulted. There are these stereotypes of the club-wielding caveman, which have been around since Victorian times. Largely because the first Neanderthal skulls found in Europe had these massive brow ridges and were very, very primitive looking. And then you got another stereotype which came about as a result of the work of a French anthropologist in the early 20th century, who studied a pathologically deformed Neanderthal burial without realizing the person had pathological conditions, and he described the Neanderthals as shambling, primitive brutes. So you've got these two long-established stereotypes, both of which actually are nonsense. From what we know now, after 100 years of research, the Neanderthals were very, very adept hunters. They were very strong, very nimble. They must have had incredible abilities at stalking animals, and great courage, because armed only with stone-tipped spears and far-hardened wooden spears, they hunted such large animals as the mammoth and the wild ox, the aurochs and the bison. And the only way they could really have killed these would literally have stalked to within a few feet of them and then jumped on their backs so they could wound them in fatal positions, unless they, of course, immobilized them in swamps or with pits. These were very strong, adept hunters. They also must have had an intimate knowledge of their environment and of plant foods. There was nothing they didn't know about their environment. And they really deserve our respect, because they survived successfully for tens of thousands of years.
You describe them as having the physique of modern wrestlers with the endurance of marathon runners. Those are very useful physical attributes. It would seem that they were stronger physically than the Cro-Magnons.
They were people of immense strength. They were very compact. Their upper arms were very well developed. And it's interesting that many of their bodies display injuries from accidents, which are remarkably similar to those of rodeo contenders today, largely because many animals there were either the smaller ones wrestled to the ground or jumped on them, and with probably considerable potential for very serious injury. No, they were strong, and the Cro-Magnons were taller, probably ran much faster, were more nimble, but were probably not as strong.
Did they share a common ancestor?
That's one of the question of questions. In the ultimate sense, yes, because all humans are descended from early hominins in Africa. The ultimate ancestor of the Neanderthals is a somewhat more archaic human, which is called Homo heidelbergensis, named after the city in Germany where the first skull, first jaw, rather, was found in the early 20th century. And there is science now from caves in Spain that there was a gradual evolution from them into the European Neanderthals. Modern humans, Homo sapiens, you and I, originally in Africa. There is now very strong genetic evidence and indeed increasing archaeological signs of this ancestry. And it seems that we evolved from some form of human who was a form of Homo heidelbergensis. But in that sense, we have common ancestry, but the details of this are still little known.
How did the tribal and family structures differ, if they did at all, between the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons?
We really don't know. The trouble with a lot of these relationships between Neanderthals and moderns is that we're really looking at what you might call the inchoate and the stuff that does not survive, the intangible, because we're dealing with people whose thoughts do not survive in archaeological sites. But it seems that the Neanderthals lived in small bands, probably of one or two families, with close relationships between members of the band. They probably lived in considerable isolation because I believe the estimate is something like 20,000 Neanderthals between the Atlantic and Central Asia. I mean, you're talking about teeny numbers of people. The number of people they would have seen in a lifetime were probably maybe 30 or 40 at the most. Contrast that with the number of people you see in a day, or I see in a day. The Cro-Magnons and their social organization didn't change much for tens of thousands of years. The Cro-Magnons appear to have had a much more sophisticated social organization for one reason and one reason alone, ultimately, and that was that they had fully articulate speech. As a result, they could communicate not only about game or plan for the future, but about nuances of personal feelings and so on. And it's clear that their social life was very much more complicated, so were their relationships with the supernatural world. You're looking at modern people living 45,000 years ago, and their social relationships must have been much more complex, much more contact with people, larger groups of people getting together, although once again the population was very, very thin.
And one thing that, of course, we love about these early modern humans is that they left behind remarkable works of art.
Oh, yes. The Cro-Magnons, and they're named after a cave in southwestern France, or the rock shelter, that was found when they were building a railroad station, of all things. And they found in it the skulls of these, or the skeletons, of a couple of these people, which looked fully modern. And they were just thought to be modern humans, Ice Age people. And it wasn't until really the 1870s that the first cave art was found. It was found by a Spanish nobleman in a cave called Altamira in northern Spain. And the beautiful polychrome paintings of bison, really lovely. And nobody believed him. They thought he had forged them. And it took a good quarter of a century before some cave paintings were found in a cave near Les Aisies, a village in southwestern France, which had been sealed up since the Ice Age. And after that, it was rapidly accepted. And what with the cave paintings and beautiful ivory and antler carvings and beautiful, beautiful ceremonial artifacts like spear throwers, we now know these people had an extremely sophisticated art. They were some of the first artists in the world, something that the Neanderthals never had.
What's your best guess, Brian, as to why they, once they discovered that they could make these images, why they did so? Was this a talisman of some kind? Were they worshiping? Were they afraid of something? Were they just really celebrating the beauty that they saw around them?
This is one of the great questions of archaeology. Have you seen any of this art yourself?
I have.
Which ones?
Well, I've only seen the ones that are in this country, and they're probably much newer.
No, this bears no comparison. Next time you go to Europe, please make a point and go. They are lovely.
Where would you go? Lascaux, or what's the best spot? Altamira?
Well, Lascaux is the famous one, but they're not showing you the original. You can only now see the replica.
Huh.
Altamira in northern Spain is, of course, the famous one. Once again, there's a replica. I was terribly lucky. I'm of the age where I could still see Lascaux in the original, and I've seen other sites with the light of an acetylene lamp, so the pictures flicker in the light. There are sites like Fond de Gaume near Les Aisy you can still visit, and Perchemel, which is another one in the Lot, which is absolutely fabulous. Do not miss the experience, because one of these days they're going to shut all the caves. They'll have to, because the paintings are vanishing.
Yeah, are they deteriorating simply because people are moving in through
Lascaux there? Oh, yes, has got serious problems.
Yeah.
And so I believe has Altamira, which they're working on, but the solution really is to keep people out, unfortunately.
So you mentioned
more like Stonehenge and the pyramids. They're being worn down by love.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, what do these mean? This is the great debate. And in the book, and I guess this is the best way to start it, I illustrate and talk about a figure found in a cave in southwestern Germany called the Lion Man. This is a remarkable ivory sculpture of a human with a lion's head. And it was carved about 34,000 years ago.
Hmm.
And it's clear that this is a picture of an animal human, maybe of a human that is being transformed into an animal. Because the big difference between Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals is that the Cro-Magnons had a very complex relationship with the world of the intangible, with the supernatural world. And this relationship was one of friendship and companionship and guidance. They considered animals to be people, much as living hunter-gatherers today do. All these hunter-gatherer societies had very complex symbolic lives. And it's clear that the paintings were part of the symbolism. For example, in some caves you will find imprints of human hands on the wall, where somebody has put their hand on the wall and blown red or black powder against the wall, and there leaves an imprint of the hand. And it's clear that this was a way that people acquired power, supernatural power, from the animals they believed lurked, the spirits, behind the walls. So you're really dealing with a relationship here with the supernatural, which we really don't understand. And this business of transformation, which is found in many societies, probably is some form of shamanism where some individuals in a group had unusual supernatural powers and were considered able to travel effortlessly into the supernatural world and to be intermediaries to the realm of the supernatural, perhaps using hallucinogenic drugs of various types to do this. So it's a very, very complex and fascinating picture.
Brian Fagan is my guest. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. We're talking about his new book, Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara, Brian Fagan. His new book is called Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. When, Brian, did modern humans begin to bury their dead?
Begin to when?
Bury their dead.
Bury their dead. This is, again, a rather complex question. The Neanderthals buried some of their dead, and there's been some debate as to whether this was religious or actually just to get the bodies out of the way of predators and get them on the ground. Modern humans invariably seem to have buried their dead. The earliest record of this we have is in the Near East, in the Levant, the eastern Mediterranean coast. But in Europe, there are burials that go back into the 30,000s. So it's a common phenomenon, and it's quite clear that burial rituals were an important part of Cro-Magnon life.
When you say rituals, were they typically buried with objects that had some kind of symbolic meaning?
Oh, yes. They were buried with often pieces of meat, jawbones. They were buried with their weapons sometimes. Often the bodies were scattered with red ochre, which has important symbolic relationships in many societies with life and death.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go first on the phones to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. I've always been a little fuzzy on where did modern man, I guess modern man is Homo sapien, did he just really sort of do another step in evolution from Cro-Magnon, or is it just sort of a gradual point, and at what point did that happen? I mean, we're direct descendants, I suppose, of Cro-Magnon, and when did that transition happen?
We are identical to the Cro-Magnons. The Cro-Magnons are Homo sapiens. We are Homo sapiens. And in fact, some recent genetic studies have suggested that a very large number, a high proportion of the people living in Europe today are genetically descended from Cro-Magnon. Indeed, I am one of them. I am technically, my genes suggest that I have a long time depth, and I am actually, you know, part of the indigenous population of Europe. But the modern humans, Cro-Magnons, migrated into Europe about 45,000 years ago, stayed there, and anatomically they haven't changed a bit since then. I mean, there have been some adaptations locally, but we are the same people, identical. So we are the direct descendants, or Europeans are, of Cro-Magnons.
And we very narrowly escaped extinction ourselves. Can you talk about what happened when Mount Toba erupted?
Ah, the Mount Toba eruption is kind of a new thing on the scientific stage. About 73,000 years ago, a long time ago, there was a massive eruption on Sumatra in Southeast Asia, where a mountain blew into space, creating a lake over 60 miles long and precipitating enormous quantities of ash and rock into the atmosphere. And this ash fell over much of India, into parts of the Near East, and also into the South China Sea. In places, it is said, it mantled parts of India with up to 3 or 4 meters of ash, if not more.
Hmm.
And the effect of this, like the famous year without a summer in 1815, the summer when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein and lived by the Swiss lakes, when the temperatures were low, there was the equivalent, they say, excuse me, of a 6 or 7 year nuclear winter, which caused temperatures to plummet over much of the world, especially in Africa. And this may well have killed off large numbers of people in Africa at a time when modern humans were at an early stage of developing their society. And it's been suggested that there was an evolutionary bottleneck and that only about 10,000 humans or more in Africa survived. Having said all that, This is still very tentative and controversial, but it does seem that the Mount Toba eruption existed. How big it was is a debate, but I suggested in the book, I stuck my neck out and said it was a really major factor.
Brian Fagan is my guest. The new book is called Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Alex in Dallas. Hi, Alex. Alex, hi, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I'm doing great.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Hello, Brian. I'm wondering, could you give me some kind of clue about the music of that time and if there was any kind of notated music left behind?
There was no notated music left behind, but they have found traces of bone flutes, which apparently have been played. I haven't really tracked this down. And these people clearly had some sort of music. They probably also had some form of drums, and they probably sang and chanted. But beyond a few blown flutes, that's literally stretches of bone with some holes in them, we really don't have any direct evidence of it.
And you do describe some of the caves where we have seen paintings as having these really amazing acoustics so that they would have been really conducive to music.
Oh, yes. One of the things that we forget about all ancient civilizations, not only the Cro-Magnons, is that people who were in charge of ritual, elders, shamans, whatever you like, were well aware of the impact that their performances, and their performances really were performances, had on the people who witnessed it. And you can be sure they made full use of flickering flame. And if you look at a flickering flame with some of the cave paintings, the paintings literally move. Smoke, scents, chanting, dance, and of course, the acoustics of caves. And, of course, this was something that the Egyptian pharaohs were well aware of, the Maya lords were well aware of, indeed the Queen of England with her coronation. These are public ceremonies to validate where they use music and pomp and ceremony. The Cro-Magnons used their caves.
I was surprised to read that in terms of underground caverns, they explored all over, but there's not real credible evidence that they actually lived underground.
No. Well, they don't think they would because of the issue of lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the issue of carnivores that live in deep caves or hibernate in them. What they did was live in rock shelters, and sometimes they actually pitched tents or put leather curtains in front of rock shelters. When they went into a deep cave, it appears to have been for ritual purposes. And I think those rituals involved sometimes groups of people. I mean, there were footprints in some of these caves. And on other occasions, one or two people, even children, have sometimes there were footmarks of children, even hand imprints of children, but also people going in alone, where people would go alone on solitary vision quests into the darkest recesses of the caves. And in some places, there are marks and animals painted in very remote chambers. And it seems it was a combination of different things.
You mentioned those leather curtains. How important was the technology of the needle?
Oh, absolutely vital. The needle is one of the most important artifacts ever invented by humanity. It looks so simple. The needle of the Cro-Magnons, used by the Cro-Magnon women, is identical to the ones we use today. Ours are sharper and finer, but they have the same purpose, and that is to tailor clothing. And anyone who lives in a colder climate, or indeed who goes mountaineering, sailing, whatever you like, makes use of layered clothing. And you take off the layers, and the clothing is tailored. And the big innovation that the needle allowed the Cro-Magnons to do was to make tailored, layered clothing. The result was that people could work outside and hunt in sub-zero temperatures. If they got hot, they simply took a layer off. If they got cold, they simply put another one on. But the clothing was fitted to the individual, and that was where the needle came in. In contrast, the Neanderthals used draped skins, which are not nearly as effective. They may have had very crude pants, but the Cro-Magnons developed this to a fine art because they used the needle and they used different types of fur for different parts of clothing. For example, if you make the uppers of boots like they wore, think Uggs, they used the skin from reindeer legs for this purpose, probably, just like Arctic people did in historic times. So it's the needle was vital.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to San Antonio and speak with Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question for you, Brian.
Good morning.
Concerning kind of both the way you determine behavior for the Neanderthal and to the numbers that you talked about, the small numbers of people, up to 30, 40 people that people would see in their lifetime. With them being so physically fit and so having to hunt, like you described, jumping on the animals, that would expose them to a lot of injury, like you talked about. You would think with such a small population that they would not be able to survive as a species as long as they did. How do you look at that and determine that that would make sense to them to put themselves at that big a risk? I mean, from the survival training that I have done, the biggest thing, the key they tell you is the animals are very lazy. They only hunt when they are sure they're going to get a kill, and they use the least amount of energy necessary to procure the food they need. I would think that would be more of a behavior you would see in a culture like that. How do you come up with the theories that you do on behavior that way?
I think you've asked actually absolutely fascinating question, which I've kind of puzzled over. I'm a sailor, and of course, obviously, one is very cautious about these things. I think the answer is severalfold. Number one, the Neanderthal technology of hunting was so simple and so basic and basically unchanged over thousands of years that the only way they could hunt an animal was to get to really close quarters. So I don't have any doubt at all that they were extremely cautious and knew the habits of the animals down to a level that you and I can't even envisage. I mean, if an animal turned its head, they probably knew what it meant. And they probably, as I said in the book, spent more time watching the animals than they actually did hunting them. They were well aware of the consequences of an accident, but unfortunately they happen. I mean, imagine trying to hunt, and we know that they eat mainly larger animals. Imagine getting to close quarters with a bison with only a sharpened stick. And if you can't immobilize the animal by chasing it into a trap or a swamp, you've got a problem, and even if you have, the slashing horns could injure you. So I think however cautious you were, you still had a problem. And they didn't have the technology we have to get off at a distance and shoot or to avoid injury. What? I'm quite sure, too, that they only hunted when they had a high-level chance of success, and they were also opportunists. So your point is very well taken, but it's not something, obviously, again, we know from archaeology. As far as the estimates of populations are concerned, the 20,000 figure I gave you is the best estimate of the experts based on site distributions and so on, but it is little more than an intelligent guess.
I guess the issue of weapons was another huge leap forward that early modern humans made.
Yes.
In that they could, first of all, their tools got sharper and smaller, and they could attach them to something like an arrow.
Yes, indeed. And the marvelous analogy for this, and it's really apt, is the Swiss Army knife or the Leatherman, because basically this is a chassis with hinges upon which you attach everything from tweezers to knives to corkscrews to whatever. The Cro-Magnons had much the same thing at a much simpler scale. They would take a piece of fine-grained flint, knock off lots of parallel-sided blades, as we call them, blanks, and then from then they would fashion all sorts of tools. Among them, a tool which we call the burin or chisel, which enabled them to make grooves in reindeer antler. And then they would lever out these slivers, and from them they would make absolutely lethal points and harpoon points, which they would mount on wooden spears, which were far more effective and much more versatile than the Neanderthals' simple spears. And one of the innovations they had was a remarkable object called the spear thrower, which is basically a hooked stick, which you hold in your right hand or left hand, and you put the foot of the spear into a hook at one end and lie it parallel, and then you propel it by shooting it forward and flicking. And this gives the spear much greater range and greater velocity, with the result that you can stand off a little more from an animal and shoot it more effectively. And this was a major, major weapon they had. So they were way ahead of anyone before them.
And you describe a pretty fascinating hierarchy. The better you were at making these spear points, the closer you got to sit to the fire.
Yeah, indeed. I think expertise at something was very important in Cro-Magnon society. Expertise in painting art, expertise in flaking stone, expertise in tailoring clothes, which was a major woman's activity, and so on. I think it was a society where people recognized that people had different expertises.
And there was no cloth made at this point in history, right? It was all animal skins?
Excuse me. We don't really know. We know they made nets, and they found fragments of simple textiles in Central and Eastern European sites, but really not enough to know. But they weren't certainly weaving fine textiles like we have.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, if they were making nets, so they did have ropes, and they used, I guess, natural fibers to make those.
They used natural fibers, and some of these nets would be very effective. For example, in the book I describe a rabbit hunt, where basically a group of people would chase rabbits into a net, which might be stretched between two rocks and so on. And these fiber nets were a vital and highly portable part of their toolkit. You have to remember, these people are on the move all the time, so all their toolkit has to be light and portable.
Brian Fagan is with us. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at UC Santa Barbara. His new book is called Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at UC Santa Barbara, Brian Fagan. His new book is called Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. We'll go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372, and this time go to Stan in Arlington. Hi, Stan.
And have two questions for Brian Fagan. First, if Europe was so thinly populated by Neanderthals, wasn't there a very serious risk of inbreeding? And second, did the Neanderthals eat only meat and perhaps fish, or did they also gather vegetables and nuts?
The chances of inbreeding among Neanderthal populations must have been pretty high. Nobody knows, but they must have had mechanisms for marrying into other bands. And they did meet a few people, so how serious the problem was, we don't know. As far as eating is concerned, the surviving evidence normally is animal bones, and we do know from studies of the isotopic content of bones that they hunted mainly larger animals. But there's absolutely no question at all that they also ate plant foods. The problem with plant foods during the late Ice Age was that the growing season probably was very short, a matter of maybe a couple of months. So most of the year they probably ate meat. So again, it's a bit of an unknown.
How did things change for the early moderns once the Ice Ages receded?
What happened was an effortless adjustment. We live in a period today of warming, and there was irregular, persistent global warming at the end of the Ice Age after about 15,000 years ago. And this followed a period of intense cold. And it's fascinating because we now see that the Cro-Magnons adjusted to this effortlessly. They didn't change the way they lived. They simply moved north. Some of them moved north, still pursuing reindeer, which was their major prey. And by 14,000 to 13,000 years ago, you find them living around the area of Paris. They moved further north and were still hunting reindeer about 12,000 years ago up in Denmark. Down in the south, however, they had to adjust because many of the great Arctic animals, like the mammoth and the bison and so on, or at least the rhino and so on, vanished, so as did reindeer. So increasingly, they concentrated on smaller forest animals and on plant foods. And it's very striking that as the climate warms, stone tools get smaller and smaller. Why? Because for the first time, they were using bows and arrows with very fine, lethal stone tips to them. So there were major changes, but there was continuity, and it was only much later, about 6,000 BC, that you get the first farmers moving into Europe from southeastern Europe.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi.
Good morning.
I'm so glad I could ask this. When you strip away the cultural differences between Cro-Magnons and us, we're basically them with better toys, I guess, or even even Neanderthals and us. I was wondering how your studies have led you to think about certain existential questions. And what is a human being if we're not spears or stone tools or even DVD players, I guess?
I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. The most striking difference between us and the Neanderthals clearly is in our cognitive abilities, our ability to plan ahead, our ability to imagine things. And there's no question, you just look at a few cave paintings or some of the symbols, it's quite clear that they had a very complex process of thinking about the world they lived in. The Neanderthals probably didn't. They weren't artists. They were living the way their predecessors had done for tens of thousands of years in virtually an unchanging universe. And with humans like us, Cro-Magnons, you get into all sorts of intangibles. We love, we hate, we die, we quarrel, we negotiate with each other, creating a much more complex society. And the complexity of society has increased and increased and increased, partly because of technology, but also because increasingly we're having to develop much more sophisticated ways of dealing with each other and societies dealing with each other. But there's no question at all that these abilities were also shared by the Cro-Magnons, although the world they were living in is unimaginably different from our own.
Back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Could Professor Fagan speculate about what might happen in 50,000 years or so when a new species of human might evolve, making us like the Neanderthals? There was an excellent novel called Dark Radio by Greg Bear where children began to be born already able to speak with superior senses. Do you think new humans would be segregated from us, the older Homo sapiens, or would we live together in our existing culture?
That's a fascinating question. Funnily enough, I was at a conference in London last week where this was a conference for the public, and one of the speakers was one of the world's leading authorities on human evolution, about which I know very little. I mean, this man is a giant in the field, and a lady asked him that specific question, and he looked her straight in the eye and said he didn't know, and he doesn't. And he has no idea. There's no question, with the large numbers of us around now, it would be very difficult for a new species of human to become established and survive. So I think it's just one of those unknowns we don't know. It's slightly frightening, but we don't know. But one way or the other, I think anyone coming up against us would have a serious problem.
Let's go next on the phones to Dallas, and there we'll speak with David. Hi, David.
Hi. Well, this dovetails perfectly into the question I was going to ask, because you refer to the Sumatra event as an evolutionary bottleneck, much like the Yellowstone caldera was, where major portions of the population were lost. Do we have any evidence that shows us what features or behaviors were selected against or for by these evolutionary events?
No, we don't. But a number of speculations have gone as far as modern humans are concerned. The first one is isolation. These were very, very sparse populations in the first place. Secondly, the nature of the African environment, and I used to live there, is that people are isolated from one another. And but with smaller populations, they tend to evolve independently in different places. Secondly, there were huge behavioral changes taking place because one of the other things that happened at the same time was that there were very intense droughts in much of East and Southern Africa. And this meant that people had to concentrate on smaller animals. And a number of archaeologists believe that modern human behavior evolved down there because of the challenge of isolation, the challenge of developing new toolkits, maybe even bows and arrows to hunt small animals, the need to wander widely to get vegetable foods and so on. So there are a lot of fascinating unknowns which people are speculating, but solid evidence we have very little.
It seems in a way that the Cro-Magnons, the early modern humans, were fortunate that when these ice ages came, they had evolved to the extent that they were able to adapt, as opposed to, I'm guessing, was it the ice age that sort of did in the Neanderthals?
It's very lucky. The Neanderthals were brilliant at adapting to much colder climates. And the way they did it, largely, was by withdrawing into warmer enclaves. Cro-Magnons did the same. They were able to survive in incredibly harsh environments in, say, eastern Russia, western Russia, or the Ukraine. But during the extreme cold of 18,000 years ago, it's clear that much of the north was depopulated. The reason the Neanderthals became extinct is something that's debated ad nauseum. The latest Neanderthal groups appear to have survived in Spain, southern Spain, in enclaves there till about 30,000 years ago. And they may have been killed by the increasing cold which came in after that, or they may have simply lost viable breeding populations and died out. Certainly they were on the margins, and certainly their numbers gradually fell until there were no more.
Let's go back to the phones one more time, and this time we'll speak with Ron in Cedar Hill. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Doctor, I have a question regarding, do they have Cro-Magnon cadavers, and do you have any ancient excrement to study for food?
Could you say that again? I didn't quite catch it.
Do you have cadavers that you can study, Cro-Magnon cadavers, and ancient excrement you can study for the food?
Mm-hmm. They have Cro-Magnon skeletons. They don't have corpses with soft tissue that I know of. And I believe they have some excrement from which they're finding a variety of animals and plant foods. But more than that, I really can't tell you.
So at the point that Cro-Magnon started to stay in one place and farm, you said that was about 6,000 BC?
4,000 years ago,
mm-hmm. Okay.
In the Near East.
And at that point, did civilization sort of mirror what we have had since then?
There was the beginnings of agriculture in the Near East, and the domestication of animals is clearly one of the greatest watersheds in history. And in terms of the Cro-Magnons, a lot in the Near East, I think a lot of farmers or hunters became farmers because it was a period of drought, and it was a logical way of expanding the distribution of the plant foods you had relied on for so long. The Europeans, on the other hand, there is debate about this, but it appears that farming began there, having crossed over from Greece and the Balkans, and large groups of farmers eventually moved across Europe and either displaced the descendants of the Cro-Magnons, or some of these Cro-Magnons took up agriculture in a very complex process, which took many, many centuries. And the genes that flow in many Europeans now are the result of this complex process.
And I guess, again, the advantage of having really higher-order thinking skills and communication skills is critical, because if you can't think abstractly about what's going to happen, if you plant the seed today, what's going to happen in 4 months, there's no way that you could practice agriculture.
Absolutely. And the idea of imagining, for example, trapping ptarmigan or Arctic foxes and saying, oh, well, here is a landscape how would these people, these animals, behave? And you have to imagine this behavior. It's fascinating stuff. Or imagining the making of a complex carving. Yes, they were us.
Are there particularly rich sites right now where early modern humans and their artifacts are being discovered?
There are large numbers of archaeological sites. In France, Germany, there are some excavations being carried out, but people are very conscious of the fact that in Victorian times, a lot of these caves were literally ransacked and excavated very unscientifically by our standards. So the excavations now tend to be very small scale and very, very fine-grained. The most important ones at the moment, I think, are being done in parts of Spain, in Germany, in the Ukraine, where there are some fascinating sites on the Dnieper and the Don, which they're really finding extraordinary stuff on mammoths and other animals. And then in Africa, where people are constantly searching for rock shelters and caves where the very earliest humans lived. And they're beginning to find the artifacts which chronicle the behavior of our first very earliest ancestors.
Am I correct that to this day there's no evidence of any specific Neanderthal genes in modern humans, ones that wouldn't have been shared by Cro-Magnons at the time?
The latest I heard, and this was last week again, is that the Neanderthal genome was pretty well being reconstructed, and the chances of interbreeding between Neanderthals and modern humans are effectively zero, however much people speculate about this.
What is your most vexing question when you think back on your career? What is the one thing that you have not been able to answer to your satisfaction?
In my whole career?
Yeah.
That's a fascinating question. I think probably it's a frustration that one cannot talk to these people. I would give anything to go back and spend a month among the ancient Egyptians, or among the Cro-Magnons, or among the Maya, because I think you would end up looking at these societies entirely differently. My biggest frustration in my career is that really we haven't yet deciphered or decoded the intangibles of our predecessors, because I think they teach us a lot.
Brian Fagan is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. His new book is called Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Brian, it's been a really interesting hour. I so appreciate you spending it with us.
Well, my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.